Good evening, everybody. My name's Josh Handelsman. I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of Film Studies, Middle East Studies, and the Department of History, I'd like to welcome you to tonight's lecture, Operation Filmmaker. As most of you saw last night, the documentary Operation Filmmaker tells the story of Muthanna, an Iraqi film student who is given the opportunity to intern on a Hollywood set. Unfortunately, it proves to be the story of a clash of cultures. Muthanna's pride is hurt when he is assigned low-level tasks, and his American coworkers become frustrated with his apparent irresponsibility. Their interactions remind us of the complicated relationship between America and Iraq and highlight our cultural misunderstandings of the Middle East. We are fortunate to have with us this evening Nina Davenport, the director of Operation Filmmaker. Her works have been screened at over a dozen film festivals, and their unique and personal style has won many awards, including Best Documentary at the Melbourne International Film Festival and Best Documentary at the American Film Institute Festival. They have even been featured on HBO, the BBC, and PBS. At this time, I would like to ask that you turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Also, please hold all questions until the question and answer session at the end of the program. Because this event is being taped and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before beginning to speak. Lastly, we request that you please complete the Middle East Studies event assessment survey if you are given one, and just give it to one of our staff on your way out the doors. And now, please join me in welcoming Nina Davenport.
That was very nice. Thank you. So I thought that I would start by telling you, although it is mentioned in the film, it's still, I think, sometimes not entirely clear to people how this project came about. So it's a lot to explain at the beginning of the film. But what happened was that David Siskel is a friend of mine from college. We both studied film at Harvard, and I will be talking a little bit more about the program at Harvard later and how I came to be the kind of filmmaker that I am. And David had admired my films, and he was making shows for MTV, specifically for the True Life series. He had made one about the West Bank, and then he made this one about Iraq that was called True Life, I'm Living in Iraq. The show profiled mostly Americans in Iraq, soldiers and nurses, and just a couple of Iraqis, including 7 minutes of Muthanna Muhammad, who had just started at the film school in Baghdad when the school was bombed by the Americans and he felt that he was no longer able to learn. Subsequently, in fact, I know that the school actually ended up moving to Jordan because as the war got worse and worse, they really couldn't function at all. But this was at the beginning of the war, and David Siskel had arrived there and found this guy and started filming him, and you see him in the MTV show going to the flea market to try to find a book about film, and he can't find a book. And he shows you that the school has been bombed, and he takes you to see the old Steenbecks, which are obsolete editing machines, although they still use them at Harvard. But nowhere else does anyone still use those old machines covered in dust, and he wipes the dust off, and he says, "How can I learn here?" And a few other scenes, you hear about how he was forced to study engineering under Saddam, but then when the Americans came, he was allowed to enter the film school, but then shortly thereafter it was bombed. And he basically sort of makes a plea to the audience saying, "How can I learn here? I want to go to Hollywood." And by chance, Liev Schreiber, channel surfing one night, happened upon this and felt really bad for Muthanna. He felt guilty about the war and guilty about America's role in the world, and he wanted to help this guy. And he contacted David Siskel and said, "What do you think about the idea of helping him and bringing him to work on this movie and also making a film about it?" David said, "Great," and contacted me. So I entered into this thinking that I was going to have a week on a film set in Prague hanging out with Liev Schreiber and getting paid. And that's about all I thought of it at the time. Because to me, and actually to David, it didn't sound like a very promising documentary film. We jokingly called it The Kindness of Liev Schreiber. That was going to be the title because it just seemed like, okay, Liev did this nice thing, so what? And it seemed like a vanity project on the part of Liev to make this film at all. So then when I arrived on set, I was escorted around by Muthanna to meet all of the people on the set, the DP, the set designer, the costume designer, and everything seemed hunky-dory. And slowly over the course of that first week, I began to realize that there was a lot of tension. And I didn't know what it was at first, but I eventually came to realize that people really resented Muthanna and felt that he was not pulling his weight on the set. And it was at that point that I realized, actually, there might be a documentary film here. Now, I was already in the business of making feature-length documentary films. That's, you know, what I've devoted my life to, and I do sometimes take jobs for money, obviously, to survive, but I wasn't going to invest further in this project if it seemed like it wasn't going to be interesting. But I realized, actually, as there was tension between Muthanna and his American benefactors, that this was an ideal metaphor for the war in Iraq. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to pursue this. I went back on a second trip on my own dime, filmed more footage, and showed it to a commissioning editor at the BBC who I worked with on my last film, and he said, this is fantastic, you have a film, you're done, this is great, I'll fund it, partially. I felt like there's more to the story. It's not enough to just have the first act, what becomes the first act, or became the first act, where you see Muthanna fighting with the very people who did this generous thing for him, he resents, they abandon him, end of story. I felt like that's not enough for a film. We need to follow this guy and see what happens afterwards, which of course required getting more funding. So I alternated between going on trips to film Muthanna and coming home and making trailers and raising more money slowly through other countries. In this case, for this film, I raised money then from Australia and Finland and Canada. And eventually, I got money from PBS, and it aired on Independent Lens in December, this past December, I think. So I just felt that the story was interesting in the first act, but it was too clever and too facile and simple, and that I wanted to pursue it. But of course, I had no idea what was going to happen or what I was getting myself into. All I knew was that I had one act of a film, and Liev Schreiber and Peter Saraf had gone home. They were editing Everything is Illuminated, which coincidentally, as you may have noticed, was a Holocaust movie, and left this guy to languish with no money in Prague. And it felt to me like now the story's getting really interesting, but what ended up happening is that it put me in a very awkward position because I was simultaneously the person making a film about and documenting this guy's life and his mother, his only family member, his confidant, his access to money, resources, power, help with visas, everything. And he'd always asked my and Kouros' advice, but the questions and demands began to escalate. And I found myself in a strange moral quandary, which I address in the film, of course, but I'm telling you more than what you see in the film. The first time that he said, can I have X number of dollars in order to get such and such visa? Because you see some of the visa stuff in the film, but there were many, many rounds of visas and visas denied and fees for visas. And The first time David Siskel and I sat down and we filmed our conversation debating what to do, David felt that he's more of a journalistic type filmmaker. I consider myself more of an artist than anything else and not a journalist. And David felt like there's a journalistic standard where you don't pay your subjects or don't give them money because it will change the story. I felt like that's worth considering, but to me, the morality of this guy needs $200. If he gets $200, he will get his visa. If he doesn't get $200, he'll get deported. And here I am able to help him, and I have all this funding for this film, and he's given me his life story. I didn't feel like I could say no to him, is the conclusion that I came to that first time when he asked us for money. And David ultimately agreed with me. But I felt like if I am going to give him money, it needs to be in the film, because otherwise the film will not be an honest portrayal of what happened. But specifically what this came down to, which is not fully in the film, it's hard for me to remember exactly what ended up in the final version and what didn't, but there was this point early on when he thought that he was actually going to have to go to a refugee camp, and it was very close as to whether or not he would get this visa, and he started threatening to not let me film if he went to the refugee camp. Of course, as a documentary filmmaker, unfortunately, when things get bad for your subject, they get better for your film in some ways. So I obviously really wanted to film him going to a refugee camp, and I was very upset at the idea that I would not be allowed to do that. But it became clear to me that it was an issue of such intense pride for him. And I do not agree with the way he looks at it at all. I actually have very serious moral problems with his perception of what it means to be a refugee. But in his mind, being a refugee meant being a loser, a bottom feeder, a scumbag, a horrible person, and he was not going to let anyone film him going to a refugee camp, no matter what. And he needed, at one point, like $200 to apply for a passport from Iraq, because originally they didn't have passports, and he needed the passport in order to apply for this visa, so we decided to give him that money. But you can see that it was very messy, and this was the first time. Now, there were many, many, many times after this of more and more demands, questions, and David and I struggling, what is the moral thing to do here? Are we supposed to just be nice to this guy? Are we supposed to be true to the film? What is the right thing to do? And we took it very, very seriously. And it was really all-consuming, really upsetting, really confusing. I have a much more cynical view on the whole experience now, sadly. But at the time, I felt that Muthanna had potential. I felt he might go somewhere. And I also really wasn't sure about what you're supposed to do in this situation. And so I basically found myself in my own personal Iraqi quagmire. And it was the metaphor that kept on giving. It just, at every turn, whatever was happening between me and Muthanna was exactly what was going on the world stage. I mean, including the time when I was desperate for more funding for the film, but felt like, why am I putting more of my life into this film that's ruining my life? But I put this X amount in. I don't want it. It's too late to quit now, so I'll just put more money into it, more of my time. You know, we were asking ourselves, is this war going anywhere? Are we wasting our money? Should we be doing this? But then a big part of it was we weren't willing to admit this is not going well. And so then we put more, there was the surge, and there was, hey, Congress, sorry, we didn't mean 10 billion, we meant 100 billion or whatever those figures were exactly when they announced that it was going to be much more expensive than they had originally said. And so to me, the film became really, more than anything, a metaphor about our relationship to Iraq, and I mean, you could extrapolate that to that from that to the entire Middle East. And that's how I knew that I had a film, which is that it wasn't just one guy's story. It was also one guy's story, though. It was an Arab man trying to make it in the West, and he's a compelling, charismatic, interesting, difficult character. And even if you just had that, it would be interesting to watch. But then you added this whole metaphorical dimension to it, and I just felt like I need to see this film to its completion, even though it was very difficult. And eventually, the film started becoming, in my mind, I had first been filming footage of him just as a back of myself interacting with him as a backup, thinking I would never use it because I envisioned never being in this film. But I thought, okay, I've got the whole scene now. I might as well just film a little extra since I'm shooting on video. I used to shoot on film, and it doesn't cost much. I'll film the part where he asked me for advice and I give him advice. And that was just kind of shelved. And then it was, you know, put to the side, we'll see what happens. And then it was, okay, now we're having this fight. I might as well just film it. You never know. And then it got to the point in the production where literally the entire substance of what was going on was our power struggle about the film, which again was a metaphor of I'm the American woman with the camera and in control, and he's the Iraqi man trying to wrest control from me. And so I at a certain point consciously realized this is going to be in the film. But then it's one thing to know that to some extent before you've gotten into the edit room, but when you start editing, it becomes very tricky to figure out how much of yourself can you get away with including without it being narcissistic, self-centered, self-indulgent, boring, irrelevant. There's all sorts of potential pitfalls that a film in which the filmmaker features him or herself can fall into. And I'll talk later about my background as a filmmaker and why it even occurred to me to consider putting myself in this film. And so I would say the central struggle in the edit room was, well, it was manifold. One was, how much can I put myself in the film and in what way? Another was, how unlikable can I make myself be without alienating the viewer to the point where they say, I don't like this person who made this film, so I don't want to watch this film. And similarly, how unlikable could I make Muthanna be without turning people completely off from the film? It was a major concern to me as I was making it that I'm making a film about a guy who's not entirely likable. That's not what people want to see. And I was really worried that this film would not do well for that reason. I also was very upset, especially earlier in the process, when I started to realize, uh-oh, this guy isn't what everyone thought he was, and maybe he's actually really not going to go anywhere or get anything accomplished, and maybe he's not even a good person, I felt really bad that here I am from this country that has completely wreaked havoc on Iraq. 11 years of sanctions, which destroyed the economy, killed people because they couldn't get medicines, the war, we've just absolutely destroyed these people, and now I'm going to make a film about one guy who's not even that good of a guy and feature him and put him all over the world on television stations to represent Iraq. This was my concern. I think in the end, I was very happy that people were smart enough to understand that, you know, it's not only about his cultural bias about issues such as pride or things that are particular to Middle Eastern culture, or not particular, but say more important in Middle Eastern culture. It's also just who he is and that he's young and that it could have been, you could find a guy who was American his age who had a really pretty serious entitlement complex too and didn't feel like serving snacks and wanted to go straight to becoming the director of the film. So, I mean, people's reactions ultimately made me feel better about this. But, you know, when you're making a documentary, you have no idea where the story is going. And no idea if also if you're ever going to be able to sell it. I mean, even though I got all of this funding from PBS, it was still no guarantee that it would actually get on PBS. In fact, I had to wait 6 months from turning in the film until they decided that they were going to program it, by which point I'd completely given up. So the distribution and fundraising and all of these elements of documentary, which I can get into more if there's time, are very difficult. And so it added to the anxiety of the process of making this film that I wasn't even sure I was adding something good to the world, and I didn't know if I was ever going to get funding to do it, or was it just going to end up all being on my credit card, or what? I mean, it was very stressful. And then by Act Three, it you see that it becomes an all-out assault on the filmmaker. It's the subject revolting against the film and just saying, "To hell with you! I'm stealing your tapes. I'm destroying you. I'm done with this film unless you give me $10,000 or whatever it is." And I think that this addresses another reason why the film has caught on to the degree that it has, is that, I mean, which is not a huge degree, parentheses, but, you know, for a documentary, it's played around a lot, is that it addresses an issue that I think comes up in a lot of documentary films that is usually something that's kept completely behind the scenes, which is that documentaries, for better or worse, are often usually made by people with money, resources, access to power, in fact, often independently wealthy, in some cases extremely independently wealthy people, about people generally who have nothing. That's what most of the films are about. You don't see a lot of documentaries about rich people, for example. And I think that there is obviously a power dynamic there, and it does come up, and you hear stories. For example, Errol Morris made this film, The Thin Blue Line, about a guy who was wrongfully convicted and on death row, and the film got him out of prison. But he then turned around and sued Errol Morris, saying, "You took my life and turned it into a movie and made money, and I want some." Or there was this French film recently, To Be and To Have, where it features this professor or teacher of a nursery school in France. It's so idyllic and so wonderful, and he seems like the most gentle, wonderful man on earth. And then it turns out that film randomly ended up doing incredibly well, because you can never predict with a documentary. The ones that do well are the ones that don't. It's utterly random. There's no way. It's completely shocking to anyone in the community of documentary filmmakers when something takes off, and no way really to explain it. And so suddenly the guy turned around and sued the filmmakers, saying, "You know, you made money off of me, etc." So these things are often part of the dynamic of documentaries, and people don't usually talk about them. And in this film, it's brought to the forefront and discussed, and you're asked to think about it and question it. So I think it's working on a lot of different levels. It's this metaphor about Iraq. It's also, in a way, about American cultural imperialism, that, you know, this guy is from a place where actually people are killing each other in the streets, and we're spending millions and millions of dollars to create this, like, zombie movie where people are killing each other on the film set, and people are going to watch it as entertainment, and those films get, American films get exported all over the world and really form, for better or worse, to a large extent, the view that people have of us out there. And so that's just a little bit of an introduction. And I was thinking that there are some DVD extras that are interesting that might touch upon. I wanted to go into more the issue of how I became a character in the film, because I think that's one thing that's different than what you're used to seeing, probably. I studied filmmaking at Harvard, which is, I would say, really the center of personal documentary film. It's kind of a well-kept secret, even from people at Harvard. They sometimes don't even know it existed. My brother went there, for example. He never once walked into the Carpenter Center for the Visual Arts. And I didn't go to Harvard for film or anything, but I happened into it. And it's not for graduate students, it's undergrads, but it's Ross McElwee teaches there. He made the film Sherman's March, which was probably It wasn't actually the first documentary film, but first personal documentary film, but people think of it as the first because it was the first one to do really, really well. And it's where he traces traces General Sherman's march through the South, the trajectory, but it's really all the women that he has dated or who have spurned him or whatever. And it's a tour of his love life while walking in the path of General Sherman. And he's made other films since. And so he teaches at Harvard, and Robert Gardner, who is a well-known anthropological filmmaker, and Rob Moss is another filmmaker there, Dick Rogers, the late Dick Rogers, and Alfred Gazzetti. And basically the way that they teach filmmaking there is unusual, which is that you have to learn to take sound, shoot, edit, produce, direct, everything. And the idea is that the film is authored initially through the camera. So it's not like that you can farm out the camera to somebody else, because the vision that you're creating in this film begins with that. And I had actually started in still photography at Harvard before that, so to me that made a lot of sense that, I mean, I couldn't ask someone else to take my photographs for me because then it wouldn't be my art anymore. So I right away had the impulse to film my own footage, and which is what we were required to do. But I think I particularly took to it because it agreed with the philosophy I already had to some extent. And they encouraged students to make films often about their families or about personal issues. If anything, I mean, not only to become filmmakers, it's not really so much, it's not geared towards churning out filmmakers, but as a learning experience, and it's something that you have, that you know very well and you have access to, and that's very doable, whereas fiction films need a lot of different people, coordination, higher budgets in order to be interesting. Documentaries can be done with very simple means. So as a result of having come out of that program, my second film ended up being extremely personal. It was called Always a Bridesmaid, and it was on Cinemax and Channel 4 in England and around the world, and it was about my love life. In fact, the movie 27 Dresses is somewhat of a ripoff of it, actually. I don't know if anyone has seen 27 Dresses. Sadly, you're much more likely to have seen 27 Dresses than Always a Bridesmaid. But it was about the fact that I was a wedding videographer and constantly filming all these giddy brides. My boyfriend was 5 years younger and he couldn't commit, and I'm trying to get him to commit, but he won't. And then I go and seek the advice of elderly, quote, spinsters, old women who decided not to marry, and they come off as the wisest, most profound people in the movie. And it touches on a lot of other things as well. But so I had made that film, which is very personal. And then my third film was called Parallel Lines, which was about a road trip I did across the country after 9/11, because I lived in New York and I had a view of the World Trade Center, perfect view of it from my apartment, but I was not there on 9/11. I was in California working on a television show. And so I just, not right after, but soon after, I got in my car and meandered very, very slowly across the country and just stopped and talked to people. And I really only had, as an idea for the film, all I had was the idea that I wanted to talk to people, I wanted to connect to people, I wanted to see the country, I wanted to take my time. That's it. And it ended up that there were a lot of themes that kept coming up in all the different people that I met, and the main theme that comes out of it is people end up talking about their own personal stories of loss. And so it becomes a film about how people deal with tragedy and loss. But it also features a lot of very funny and lovable and wacky American characters along the way. And I was in that film not as telling my inner thoughts, but as a New Yorker who wasn't there. Certain things about me came out in that film. And you see my face occasionally. My first film as well was about India. I spent a year there and traveled around and learned Hindi. And that film is called Hello Photo. And that film was about a Westerner looking at India and how India is looking back at me as a Western woman. So even that film, although there's no dialogue and almost no talking at all, the fact of that I'm the person behind the camera and certain things about me again come across in that film. However, when I started Operation Filmmaker, I had no intention whatsoever of being in the film, and I thought, what a relief. The last thing I want to do is make another film that I'm going to be in, because it's actually much more difficult to make a film that you're in. It makes the editing a lot more challenging, because the issue of how much do you keep yourself in and how much you cut yourself out is so tricky that I just didn't want to even go there, and I had no intention of it. But I found myself slowly and inexorably being drawn into the story to the point where there was absolutely no turning back, and I would have been stupid to not see that this power struggle between me and Muthanna was the perfect metaphor for America and Iraq, and I had to film it. But I came to that conclusion reluctantly. And one thing I was thinking I would show you in terms of just the issue of how I had to figure out how much of myself to put in the film. I'm just going to show you a scene it's kind of amusing, but it also, it's by way of saying, you know, this is something I did not include, and I can talk about why, and that, you know, there are 400 hours like it, 400 hours of things that I chose not to include. And because I think the process of editing a documentary is the hardest, and I really think in some ways the most creative part, because unlike fiction where you have a script and a plan, with documentary, you have, at least if it's going to be a good documentary, that is, you have no plan. Most documentaries, in fact, are made where the director has a preconceived agenda of, these are the things I want to preach about or tell people or teach or convey, and they go in and they get the shots to match the script that in some cases has literally already been written, and the shots are just kind of filler. And I work the opposite of that. When I go into a situation, I'm completely open-minded. I recognize I have no idea where it's going to go, and I'm prepared to go potentially in a completely different direction from the one I originally thought. Personally, I feel that the best films are made that way. I can cite, just pick one other random example, the film Capturing the Freedmans. You may have heard that it originally began as a documentary about New York City's best clown. That's what Andrew Jarecki was making a film about, and this particular clown at one point just happened to mention that both his father and brother were accused of child abuse, and that there were hours and hours and hours of footage recording the whole thing, and it became Capturing the Freedmans. But I think it's really important to be open to the world, open to experience, and to be open-minded, really, and when you're making a documentary, and I think the best films come out of it. But so here's just an example of something that I decided not to include. Let's see if I can... I'm not sure what to do. Okay, here. I can't stand him anymore. I'm sick of being accused of doing stuff wrong when I haven't done anything, and of ruining his life when I haven't done anything, and I'm trying to help him, and I'm trying to help get him a visa to come to New York. I bring him clothes, I pay for his food when I'm here. This happens all the time. It's like this vicious cycle. It's like one day he's nice, the next day he's a jerk. I can't stand it. Is it worth it, you know? I mean, I try to just take the abuse, kiss his ass, be nice, because I'm making a film about him. But at a certain point, I can't keep my mouth shut. Why are you coming back? Okay. Bye. Okay, now he's coming back.
I'd like to remind the audience of what Muthanna was just telling me, that I should be grateful that I get to tell his story and film him. And I just want to set the record straight that at the moment, I do not feel even remotely grateful. If I'd known what I know about him now, 8 months ago, I would not have embarked on this film, because it has made my life really, really unpleasant and really difficult. And if I weren't already 8 months into this and agreed to make the film for the BBC, I would bail in a second. I want to go home.
So, it also is a good thing to show just the level of desperation that I got to in dealing with this person, Muthanna. But I felt that if you were privy to every single moment that I was, you would definitely be on my side. But you know, the viewer is not privy to that, and the fact is, he's a refugee of war, whereas I get to go back to my comfortable city of New York. And I felt that this would read as petty and potentially self-centered. And if I could have pulled it off to appear funny, to make people laugh, I might have included it, but it didn't feel like it was going to read that way. So that's just an example of something that didn't make it in. And in fact, there's the huge blowout fight in the film that you see in Act 3. There were many, many, many fights and arguments on film, hours and hours and hours of them. And I had to go through and relive them over and over and over again and figure out which ones should make it in and which ones shouldn't. But I could keep talking forever, but why don't we take a few questions and see where we go.
Hi. So after I watched this movie, I was really curious to figure out what happened to him. So I went on Google, and there's not even a Wikipedia page for this movie. And whatever happened to this guy? Like, I'm really curious.
Whoa, is that bad that there's no Wikipedia page? Does that mean I'm a nobody? Oh my God, I still don't even know what Twitter is. So I barely know what Wikipedia is. I'm old, I guess, but. Well, he did get a 5-year extension on his visa in England, which was a pretty amazing coup, and I'm sure that he used the documentary to claim that he would be the subject of attacks or whatever in Iraq, which I personally don't believe, but so he did get 5 years, and he was, I know, awaiting tables in a restaurant, which means he got over his pride, because the BBC, who had to field almost daily calls from him threatening to sue, they all knew who he was. They all went out to lunch one day near the BBC, and he was their waiter, and they were completely shocked and terrified and kept their mouth shut. So that has been verified by a third party. You know, somehow he's managing to continue to survive in London, which is a very expensive city. I'm not sure how. I don't talk to him anymore. I made the decision at some point that, I mean, basically I was in, the film kind of hints at this, but I don't go fully into it because, again, it felt like it was going to actually make the film less interesting. But it was like being in an abusive relationship. Where instead of it being like the guy that I wanted, like a battered woman who still wants to be with her man, it was the film. You know, like I wanted the film so badly that I was willing to be treated horribly for a long time. And so I, at a certain point, just realized that that dynamic was so poisonous to me and so unhealthy that I just categorically cut him off. I blocked all his emails. And I told David Chisgall that I was never going to speak to him again, and I have not. David talks to him a fair frequently, though. Often it's something that he wants. You know, he's still, I think his dream still is to get to New York. And so he, I'm sure we'll remain in touch with David for a long time. And the thing is, since I was not the person who started this mess, it was easier for me to walk away. Whereas, really, the person who started it all is David Siskel. He won't admit this, but by portraying this guy as something completely different than who he actually is. And that's another clip that I'd like to show that I found. I don't know if you'll find it as interesting as I did, but when we finally got around to watching the video diaries that Muthanna had shot in Jordan, I couldn't believe my eyes. Basically, David got him a camera and shipped it, or gave him money to buy a camera in Jordan, and that's where he was when he was waiting to get his visa in the Czech Republic. And there was a long period of time when it wasn't clear whether he was going to get it or not, and he was waiting there, and he was anxious. And during that time, he shot video diaries. He was with a friend of his, Dia, who ended up getting out. Almost all of his friends got out of Iraq. Dia went to Belgium and showed up to a screening at the Rotterdam Film Festival. That was a shock. And another one of his friends showed up at a screening at the Toronto Film Festival. It's a much smaller world than you think. And they, by the way, validated that this is what Muthanna's like, although I think he's much worse than what I portrayed. But so when we saw this footage of these video diaries, it was fascinating to me because the writing was on the wall from the very beginning. I mean, if you see these, you will see that everything about him comes across. I tried very hard to figure out how to put these in the film, but it just, there was no way. So that's one of the reasons I included it in the deleted scenes, because it was painful to have to cut it out. So here's Muthanna waiting for his visa in Jordan and not knowing if he was going to get it or have to go right back to Baghdad.
I'm waiting. My American friends told me Peter and Liev, I called them this day in the cellular, and I was very happy to hear their voice for the first time, and they told me be patient and be strong. And I'm always.
Everything here is calm and safe and beautiful, and you can see the human beings' actions in a very, very normal way.
You know what? I'm dreaming. Oh, shit. That's kind of like, hey, you get out!
Tomorrow I will turn back to Amman and see what's gonna happen. Suppose I'm gonna chat with my American friend Kouros to see about the project, about to find out about the visa. I wish it happens. I need this very, very much. It's a comprehensive solution for all my life. This will change my life for next 40 or 50 years. Can save me. We are celebrating here with a heavy metal concert because the occasion is I get finally the visa. Yeah, man, I did it.
Well, you gotta thank the people who worked hard for you.
Of course.
Because you have no idea how hard such things to be achieved. I mean, sometimes it can be impossible, and you've experienced that. I mean, you really experienced that through what happened, I mean, a few days ago.
This is their credit, not mine. This is them, not me.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, but...
they selected me, I know that. And maybe I spoke... in a very special way in my MTV show, but they give me the hand.
I want my friend, which is you, you stupid shithead, I want you to have the biggest confidence ever. I want you to be fully confident about yourself, because no matter what, they wouldn't choose you if you don't have something inside. A filmmaker, he can see in you. Or people, sometimes when they see some people spiritually, they communicate each other and they feel that those people have something, but which they haven't explored yet. And maybe with this trip, with this experience, you'll explore that thing and you'll reach, and you'll be the shed that'll hit the fan, okay?
I love that. You'll be the shit that will hit the fan. That's a good quote. I hope you could understand him, because I forgot his English gets much better as the film goes on. But this was so. I hope people can understand some of the lines. But I just think what's amazing about that is the moment where he says, "I did it." It sums everything up. He didn't do anything. He just happened to be on MTV and he got lucky. That's one way of looking at it. And yet he starts to take credit for it and his ego starts to get huge from the beginning, because he's been chosen by this American star who, by the way, he'd never even heard of. But then on the other hand, he did do it, because he did manipulate Kouros and the MTV crew, because he was trying to get something out of it. And I'm going to show you another scene where Kouros asked Muthanna, why did you do this MTV piece? What were you thinking? Because we felt that it wasn't a straightforward example of somebody who's just like, oh, you want to follow me doing my thing? I'll just do my thing and you can document it. It was a guy who was conniving to get something. Now, was he trying to get invited by a movie star to work on an American movie? I'm sure he never dreamed of that, but he was trying to get something, and you see him talk about that.
there's a lot of different kinds of reality, you know? And when I ask you, to what degree did you and Nazar think about what you were going to show the camera?
By the way,
let me finish.
Okay.
I'm not accusing you of lying, but you had a sense for, okay, this would be good for the camera, this won't be good for the camera, let's create this story, let's give him that story.
Okay, I'm an Iraqi person, I'm simple student, I don't have much chances to find many foreign cameras around me to use it. When you called me in one night and you told me you want to make me a story, I didn't say no, because I need this kind of help. I couldn't find other choice, no one helped me at all. We were a bunch of young people trying to make something.
But specifically, it was the story of you looking for a book, a film student looking for a film book, mm-hmm. that captured the imagination of an American actor, filmmaker, and said, I want to help this guy. This guy looks like... How do you understand? How do you explain that?
You're telling me that there's kind of arrangement, so there's kind of preparing. I'm not against that. That's... I think I should. This is the right way how to tell people stories. We have to know what we should tell them and what we should not. I'm not against that. I'm really proud of that show. And just thinking that about that I'm appearing at MTV, whatever was the context, it's really a huge achievement for me. And it's a huge American channel, and they gave me that. And the proof, I told I'm here because of the MTV.
That also did not make it into the film. But Quaros and I did think at one point that we were going to keep referring back to these moments in MTV that captured Liev's imagination, the moment where he's looking for the book and he can't find it. I think... One reason that didn't happen is the footage was not very well shot, and therefore, and nor are his video diaries. And you know, Quaros' footage was not well shot, and Muthana's footage was not well shot. So it's kind of flat. But we did think that we were going to do that at one point. But I think it's really interesting to see what was Muthana's perspective. And first of all, the idea that he views it as an achievement to have appeared on MTV is interesting to me, whereas he just randomly ended up on it. I mean, it's not, he's just being the subject. He's not directing it or responsible for it. And also that, you know, he says, he basically admits, yeah, I went to the book market because you have to know what to tell people and what not to tell people when you're making a story. So that he, you know, as the subject is crafting the story too. And I think it speaks to the degree to which reality TV and MTV culture has infiltrated like far-flung parts of the globe, so that this guy who never has been, you know, lived under an incredibly harsh dictatorship, never has been on an airplane, never has left Iraq, nonetheless is savvy enough to calculate how to appeal to MTV. And so I think it also distorted everything for him from then on. If by doing that he could land this, get out of the hellhole of Iraq, and then just by asking the Rock for money, he could end up in London. I mean, the sky was the limit. So, you know, when we couldn't get him to the United States, it was like, what do you mean? What, everyone else has given me the red carpet treatment, but he just had no sense of reality. So the question, you know, was often on our minds, was it better for Muthana that he was invited out of Iraq? Or did it corrupt him and ruin him? And because there were many low moments and many moments where he didn't have any confidence and it was very hard for him. I mean, you know, given where Iraq has gone since then, I think the question is pretty sadly clear. Like, it's pretty much good for anyone to get out because it's so dangerous. But it wasn't so clear at that point what was going to happen. And really, you know, he's the only one who can really answer that question. I'm sure he would say, "Are you hell yes, I'm so glad I get out of there." I think he always wanted to get out. And he just happened to find his miraculous way out. But anyway, you had a question?
Answering your question, whether it was better for him to... you said that he lost a sense of reality. Of course he's lost the sense of reality. That's his first time outside of Iraq. is completely taken outside of this reality. He, from the very beginning, what I felt is that I thought that at the end something wonderful will happen and he will probably become a wonderful filmmaker. And I'm looking at him thinking, they must be so perceptive because I see a very mediocre character.
A very what character?
Mediocre. And so I was kind of waiting for something to happen, and what was happening in my mind is that gradually he was created into a monster. And so he was taken outside of his reality, he lost the reality, and he was taken advantage of by continuing this existence, which was so unreal. And at the end, you know, it had to stop, and he lost it completely. And that's kind of my read of it. And so the metaphor that comes to mind is when I hear the critique of Bush, I always say, well, he never presented himself as anything, anyone smarter than he is, and yet the majority of Americans voted for him. And so it seems to me that he did not present himself as anyone who is more talented than he is, and there was a mistake made, and then the people who sponsored him were not perceptive enough. And then at the end, he got blamed for this lack of perceptiveness. That's kind of my read of it.
Well, I mean, first of all, I should clarify that, you know, and I mean, really what I wanted to say is all in the film. I mean, including what's in and what's not in. I mean, that's where I stand on this and what I wanted to convey. So in a way, once I start talking about it, it gets into territory that is, you know, often deliberately left out. I mean, for example, if you get me talking about it, you're going to hear that he's like a much worse human being than what comes across in the film. Because I actually made an effort, I toned down his dark side as much as I mean, a lot, basically. But I think it's complicated. I think that, you know, what you're saying is true, that he was kind of, in a way, used. I think Liev probably had this a hero complex and wanted to think of himself as a hero, and he's spotted a way to do it. But on the other hand, Muthanna was manipulating the MTV crew from the beginning. What he says, I guess it's not in this sequence, but what he finally, after being pushed and pushed by Kuros, admits is that he wanted to get funding for a film that he was trying to do. So, you know, there's no real crime in that, but he was misrepresenting himself. He claims he comes off as someone who's very eager to learn. If you actually see the whole MTV piece, and he has no desire to learn. He didn't ever open a book or study anything ever in film school. He didn't know how to even turn the camera on and off. That was the sort of final stage of disillusionment with him. For me, was the other film school students at the London Film Academy who said that he was just a user and didn't help anyone ever, but would get everyone to help him, and he didn't learn anything. He didn't know how to use the camera. He didn't study. He didn't care. And but you know, obviously, Liev Schreiber didn't. And Peter Schraff, they didn't do any background check on this guy or anything. They just completely believed hook, line, and sinker what they saw on MTV. And that, you could argue, is very irresponsible to pluck somebody out of their country where they're going to be permanently changed. I mean, he says in the video diaries, this will be my salvation. This is going to change my life for the next 50 or 60 years. He's well aware of the fact that if he gets out of there, his life will never be the same, and there's no turning back. But I don't think what they thought about was that there's no turning back. They didn't think about, what are we going to do with this guy when the movie's over? And he, you know, doesn't know anyone here. And by the way, you know, in Middle Eastern culture, if you invite someone to be your guest, that's it. I mean, you can't just say, see you later, I got to go. I mean, it doesn't work that way there. People are much more hospitable and feel much more responsible to friends and relatives than they do in this country. So, you know, they just didn't think about it. And so what I struggled to do in the film is kind of show that nobody's hands come out clean. Like everybody's hands are dirty. Mine, Muthanna's, Peter, Liev, everybody. The Rock, you know, Mr. I mean, he's innocent and sweet and gives Muthan the money, but I mean, you know, he wants the cameras to film him while he's doing it. I mean, it's just, there's so many layers to it. And so I tried to keep it, to make it as complicated and layered as possible. And there's, you get very mixed reactions. Some people think, you know, Muthan is a psychopath. Other people think that Peter and Liev are horrible, egotistical, maniacal assholes. I mean, it's all over the place. You know, unfortunately, my view of it now is actually a lot more simplistic than what the film would suggest, which is, you know, I got to know him so well in so many different circumstances, and I think he's, you know, a narcissist and the most self-centered, selfish person I've ever met in my life, and he has no morals, and he's lazy, he's good for nothing, loser. It's basically how I feel about him now. And so I feel like all those hours that I spent, like, debating about what to do and what's the morality of this and should I give him that and all the things that we did for him, I just feel like, you know, given that I have one life on this planet Earth, that now feels to me like wasted time. And I'm very just kind of jaded about him and the whole situation. On the other hand, I feel like I could afford to get to that place because I didn't initiate this whole thing. I'm very glad that I am not Liev Schreiber. I'm not the person who said, oh, this sounds like a great idea. Let's do this. And then you're stuck with it for the rest of your life. Because for me to walk away, I don't know if I would have been able to. It was hard enough to walk away, and I didn't start it. And they did. On the other hand, having been through what I went through with him, I can't really blame them for walking away either, because he is so difficult to deal with and so unpleasant that I can't really blame them for walking away. And, you know, he is better off now. I mean, he's happy, you know, to the extent that he's capable of happiness, which is limited. But, you know, Iraq is a disaster. It's dangerous and horrible. We destroyed it. The war was a failure. I mean, it's the saddest story ever. I think we even forget. We already have forgotten how horrible it was to have Bush as a president and how horrible the war was and what a huge mistake. And so in a way, you know, who am I to say he would have been better off if he hadn't ever left, when he wouldn't say that? I think that's presumptuous. It would be presumptuous of me to make that claim. What'd you say? No, that's not, I mean, I don't, that's not true at all. Like, he is obsessed with the West and even more obsessed with New York specifically. Now, what happened was the scene where he asks Peter and Liev for money to buy a camera. Basically, his visa was running out and he kept asking them, for a long time, saying, will you get me a visa to the States? And then when it got down to like 48 hours when his visa was going to expire and he lost faith that they were going to get him a visa, he said, okay, I've decided I'm going to go back to help my family. And by the way, will you buy me a $3,000 camera? And then miraculously at the final hour, he did get the visa. And suddenly he's on the set and like this whole idea of I'm going to help my family is out the window. And that's when that leads to that big confrontation in the stairwell with Peter Sarraf saying, what do you mean? Now, so you were just talking about this and now you're saying something different. It sounds like you're just saying whatever sounds good. And that is true. I mean, he was completely lying about he was never going to go back under any circumstances. I believed it. Koros was always saying he will never go back no matter what, because you can always just become illegal, or he could have gone to Damascus or any number of places. There's no way in hell that he was ever going to set foot in Iraq again. And everything about how he realized he needed to help his family was complete bullshit. He only ever mentioned his family when it served his purposes. He never does anything for them.
Yeah, I was really curious that, the film focused so much on him. Obviously, it was his story. But
in some ways, you could have slanted it so that perhaps Liev turns out to be something of the villain in this. I mean, he was the one who started it. He was absolutely irresponsible, I think, not to have done the background research to find out what he was like. He took him out of there, and it turned out not to be what he thought it was. And it seems he just, finally just said, I've had enough, and he left. It just seemed to me that the film should have been somewhat harder on Liev.
Well, I mean, it doesn't really, overtly pass judgment on anyone ever. I mean, it's just kind of what people take away from it. I mean, a lot of people do take away that Liev is a complete asshole from the movie, you know? I mean, and some people hate Peter Sarraf even more. So, I mean, it did do that for some people. I don't ever state how I feel specifically, really, about anything except at the end, I say, too bad I don't have an exit strategy.
Right.
But, I mean, just if you want to know the details, I mean, he did say this was just an internship of X number of months, and then he had to go back. I mean, that was the agreement. It was, in fact, they had to promise the Czech minister in order to get the visa that Muthanna would go back, and he had to promise that he would go back. So, I mean, that was the deal. However, I think it's more complicated than that when you expose someone to a world of privilege who comes from a war-torn hellhole. It's not so simple as just saying, okay, let's agree now before you get here. You have to go back. I mean, but he did also, and the thing is that in a way it's not really, I mean, it is Muthanna's story, but it's also Muthanna is a cipher for all of these Westerners who project their fantasies onto him, including me. And to me, that's what's really interesting is how he affects all the people around him. I mean, there are several people who are in tears. They're so moved by his situation. Or people getting angry, or people thinking he's going to be, the next Martin Scorsese. Or, I mean, everybody's got these ideas, and it's all just projection and fantasy. And I was guilty of the same thing. In my case, my agenda was, oh my God, I started this film not realizing that this guy was maybe, as you say, mediocre and worse than that. And like, oh no, how do I get a happy ending? I don't want to make a film that's negative about an Iraqi. Oh Jesus, maybe I'll start steering him in the right direction by giving him advice. Like, here's how you talk to these people. Don't lie. They don't like it when you maybe you can lie in the Middle East. You can't lie here. Like, I don't know how it works over there, but people don't like it when you seem dishonest or why are you working more on the gag reel? I mean, I was one of the people nagging him saying this is a chance to redeem yourself and do something good and learn to edit. And, I was like a nagging mother giving him advice. And that was partly because my agenda was a happy ending for my film. The moral scheme behind that is like, I care about Iraq. I don't want to make something negative about Iraq. But nonetheless, it was my agenda. It wasn't just like his life. And so everybody's projecting onto him, and he's a cipher, and he knows exactly how to manipulate people and give them just enough information, but not too much so that they can imagine whatever they want to imagine about him. And he was a genius at that.
Yeah, I notice also in lots of other documentaries significant documentaries that also dealt with people who were struggling, very much, as was the case with this one. I'm thinking particularly of Hoop Dreams that comes to mind. You really don't see the filmmaker at all, that they are behind the camera and that they never enter in any significant way in front of the camera. And so I'm wondering if what you did really broke a certain rule that is expected of documentary filmmakers.
I mean, I don't think so, because they're probably not as well known generally, because they tend not to win Academy Awards or or even festival awards as easily. I mean, I think it's actually much more difficult to make a good personal film than one in which you're not a character. It's very hard to pull it off, and it requires a lot more time in the edit room. I mean, as soon as you say, I'm going to be a character in this film, you can add another 6 months to your editing time, because people are so prone to judge it is one of the reasons. And it's very hard to be objective about yourself and to look at a cut and say, like, oh, what do I think of this character who is a construction of me? And so I think those films don't do as well. But Sherman's March is real. You know, a lot of people have heard of it, but nowhere near as many people have heard of that as have heard of Hoop Dreams, for example, even though it was the top grossing documentary ever when it came out. And so I think that, but wait, I'm sorry, what was the question? Because now I feel like I kind of went off on a tangent. Oh, right, yes. Well, there's a whole, what I was going to say is there's a whole tradition of personal documentary filmmaking, and Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Harvard are really the epicenter of it. And it's caught on more. I mean, a lot more people are doing it now. It used to be quite rare, but there are many, many personal films now. Unfortunately, a lot of them are bad, and they give them a bad name. I think one of the tricks is to be self-deprecating and funny. That's one of the things that is required when you're making a very personal film. The film I'm making now actually is the sequel to Always a Bridesmaid, and it's about deciding to have a baby on my own with a friend, sperm, at 42. He's in the hall. We can hang out with him afterwards if you want. His name is Jasper. He's 9 months old. So I'm in the process of making that film, but it will include other single mothers in New York and my mom's death and all sorts of, you know, it'll film footage of my family over many years, et cetera. Many themes will come out in the film. But I think that, I guess I keep returning to that genre because it's kind of the way I was taught originally. But also I think that when you're making a personal film and therefore it's tied together with your voiceover, it allows you to pull in from all different sources and situations and tangents and digressions. And in a way there's more poetry. There's more potential for poetic moments in those films than a straightforward film. I'm not talking about this as an example of a very personal documentary. I'm talking about one where it's like I'm the main character and I'm narrating my story. So I just artistically, to me, it's the most inspiring genre, partly because it's the hardest to pull off. And then I think when you've actually pulled it off and people love it and they want to see it and they're talking about it and you've managed to turn your life into cinema and the people you know and love who are close to you into characters that people identify with, it's incredibly satisfying. It's like you've created art, but you've also documented the things that mean the most to you. So I think that's why I keep returning to it, although every time I swear I'm never going to do it again because it's so difficult.
One more question.
I was just wondering if you could talk about which were some of the difficulties in working with Muthanna that you could attribute not to his being a terrible person, but to the cultural difference.
I mean, that's a question that comes up a lot that puts me in an awkward position because who am I to be an authority on Iraqi culture when I've never even been to Iraq? I would say that my impression is that, for example, the issue of pride, I get the sense that for men, pride is a very big issue in the Middle East, more than it is here, and that they tend to get hung up on it. And when, from my Western point of view, my feeling is get over yourself. You know, get over yourself and get a job, or get over yourself and serve the coffee, or whatever. Nothing is beneath you. We're all, you know, if we're privileged, it's because we were born lucky. It doesn't say anything about you inherently as a person. And so I found it difficult to be sympathetic to that, but I think some of that was cultural. On the other hand, I think there are people who might have adapted more quickly to that than he did. You know, he did adapt, though. I mean, you got to hand it to the guy. He adapted. I mean, he's, you know, and he figured out a way to stay. So, and then, you know, often people ask me about women. Do I think that he didn't respect me because I'm a woman? You know, sure, there's some of that. You know, you can see he's talking about his mother usually washes his underwear. I mean, he'd never literally ever cooked or cleaned or done anything ever. On the other hand, you could say that about a lot of men in this culture. So, I mean, maybe it's just men, you know? I don't know. But I would never feel comfortable doing anything other than musing upon that question, but giving an actual answer, I really don't know. But the film certainly does make you think about what is culture and what is personality. Should we take one last one?
It seemed to be me that his main problem was that he was more naive about what was going on, because it seemed to him that this would be the greatest opportunity of his life, and people made out to be that way. And it seemed his pride came from the fact that he was just disappointed. I mean, the fact that you support him at all, thought that you made him think that you were a reliable source, because you did say it is culture to guess or always guess and such. So it just seemed like he was naive that he wasn't as lucky as he wanted to be, or as our people made him seem to be. What do you feel about that?
I mean, definitely there was a degree of naivete that was immense, which is another reason why I think that video footage is interesting, you know, where you see him like combing his hair and spraying the deodorant like on the outside of his shirt, and he's looking at the girls and he's like, oh my God, girls in bikinis. And, you know, this is a guy who's been like shut up in a dictatorship his whole life. And so, of course, he gets to Prague, and what does he want to do? Hit the bars and pick up girls. Big surprise. I could have predicted that. And I also think that he did say a couple times, and it's so astonishing that it's almost hard to believe, but that he thought that he might be co-directing the movie. Now, I just keep in mind that he had never made a single film before he got there. He had been in film school for 2 months, so he didn't know anything about film. And yet, somehow, so, you know, obviously I would never judge him for that in a million years. In fact, the opposite, it makes you feel like, what the hell were they doing bringing this guy without knowing anything? You know, they didn't talk to his teachers, they didn't... I mean, you know, I've met all of his friends, and there is a commonality. They all are difficult and entitled and a pain in the ass, but he was the worst. I mean, so they picked the worst one of that little crowd of filmmaking guys. You know, the others had more talent and more adaptability and have gone further since. Nazar, who is featured in some of the MTV piece and who does some of the video diaries in my film, you know, he's clearly more talented. You know, would have been nice to pick somebody who actually had a knack for filmmaking as opposed to somebody who just wanted to be a filmmaker. Lots of people want to be filmmakers but don't have any talent. And he shouldn't be blamed for that. Yes, I think we need to end with a professorial question. Well, I think one of the reasons, I mean, there were a bunch of reasons why I realized I really needed footage of his friends in Iraq. And one is that I found myself, it was very easy he kind of adapted very quickly in terms of his style and his way of speaking, and he seemed very Western in a way. So you had to remind yourself, like, oh my God, this guy comes from Iraq. That's, you know, he was lived under a dictatorship. I found myself easily forgetting that and forgetting what he would be doing if were it not for this miraculous thing. What would his life be like now had he not gotten this chance? And I realized that if I was having trouble forgetting, that the audience might need to be reminded of this is what he's escaping. So that was my original motivation. And then, you know, one of the sort of inadvertent results of that is that people sometimes feel like, oh my God, you know, too bad they didn't pick Nazar instead of him. And what kind of film would this have been if Nazar had been chosen or if some other person had been chosen? So I think it actually was good in terms of, you know, my concern was there that this would contribute to racism or prejudice against Iraqis because they think like they're all like him. And in fact, seeing his friends, I think people realize that, you know, they're not all like him, or that the film would, each person would have led to a different film, maybe with some similarities, but it wouldn't have been the exact same story with any Iraqi guy that you picked up by any means. And I mean, I think that I kind of did what I did the most that I could with what I had, and getting the footage from them was extremely difficult. I mean, cameras were, you know, missing and stolen in the process. Nazar was lying to me and telling me all these crazy stories, and it's a long story, but it was really hard to get that footage, and there wasn't a ton of it. So I think that I probably, you know, used just enough to get the point across, and I don't think I needed more. But I also didn't necessarily have a ton more. There was a whole thing in Nazar's, I mean, like, at the first tape was that Nazar sent me was of him, shots of him being filmed using a bigger, better video camera, making a documentary about the Marsh Arabs. And I'm like, okay, this is not a vanity piece. You're a macho filmmaker with a big camera making a National Geographic-type documentary. I want just, like, your life day to day. So then the next round was he said that he had been threatened by the insurgents, that they said that they'd kill him if he didn't work for them. They were going to pay him $750 a week, or he would be dead meat. He had no choice. And he sent me this long email. He said, I even have it on camera when they called me, and I started crying and blah, blah, blah. So I watch all these tapes. It's shot in black and white video, and it includes this shot where it's looking up at Nazar, and there's a fan going around, and he's smoking a cigarette, and it's almost like it looks like a film noir. And the phone rings, and it's the insurgents, and he's pleading for more time. And the more I watched of this footage, I realized the entire thing was fabricated. It was like a film noir by Nazar about being pursued by insurgents. But the thing is, Nazar, like, if you think Muthanna lives in a fantasy world, Nazar does even more so. For all I know, he, like, actually thinks it happened, but I can just tell you, looking at the footage, it was definitely not true. And I showed it to a couple of Iraqis, and I said, you need to watch all of the tapes and notice the order of things. Like, he said that he was hiding, but then he's, like, out socializing on the street. Like, it just didn't all fit together. So, but I think that was an interesting, I tried to use that in the film because I thought it was really interesting, because it was an example of which a question that's raised by the MTV piece as well, which is that he was probably giving me what he thought I wanted. And that's another element at work with Muthanna, is he's kind of, you know, we're so conditioned by this MTV culture that you suddenly find yourself on MTV and it's like, let's give MTV what they want. You know, let's pretend to be a victim, or let's, you know, seem desperate or whatever it is, because that'll make for good TV. And, you know, not that he was trying to pull one over on me. I think the more likely explanation is he was trying to give me what he thought I wanted. And sure enough, I was like, oh my God, I have footage of Nazar being pursued by insurgents. This is going to be great for my documentary. And so I tried to include it in there where it would seem fake, But there was no way to do it because it's like, you know, I couldn't pass it off as real in good conscience. And I couldn't say it was fake without him admitting it on camera that it was fake because that would seem incredibly callous. So I ultimately had to not use it. But anyway, that's a nice little anecdote to end on. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
On behalf of our co-sponsor, I'd like to thank Ms. Davenport once again for coming to Dickinson. And just to remind everybody, we would really appreciate it if you could fill out the Middle East assessment survey and hand it to one of our staff on the way out. Thank you very much for coming. This concludes our event. Have a safe trip home.